Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
A star-studded career.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting folks in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This is episode 251, our 2018 Christmas Jollies episode with Bill Adler. Every Christmas since 2013, we've sat down with Bill, who's the former head of PR at Def Jam, among numerous other accomplishments, to talk about his world-famous Christmas Jollies mix. Bill spends the whole year scouring record stores, flea markets, the internet, and everywhere in between to find the perfect batch of great holiday music. And then he shares it with his select mailing list and with us. In this episode, we talk to him about some of this year's selections. You can find Bill's mix in its entirety on our SoundCloud page. That's soundcloud.com/TheCipherShow. While you're listening, head over to www.thecyphershow.com to check out show notes, playlists, and our archives. If you're in the mood for more Jollies when you're done with this episode, check out last year's special on episode 228. And now, here's the Jew with the most Christmas spirit since Jesus himself, Bill Adler.
So, how have you been since last Christmas?
Wow. I've been fine. You know, I always console myself. You know, I tend to see things, I tend to see the big picture these days because it's unavoidable. And I'm speaking about the nonsense in Washington. So by contrast to that shit show, by contrast to the pain being felt all over the world, you know, in my little life, I'm doing fine. I get to continue to live in New York City. I'm happily married. My kids are well. I do the kind of work I want to do. I get three meals a day. I'm fine. Thank you.
Great. And, you know, speaking of three meals, you are married to a famous television chef.
That's true.
Yeah. How are her various projects going?
Oh, Sarah Moulton. She's doing fine. Up until, you know, some of the print media she was working with have since kind of gone up in smoke, or the jobs have gone up in smoke. So she was writing a column for the Washington Post Sunday magazine for several years, and that's not happening anymore. And likewise, she did a weekly column for the Associated Press for 6 years, I think, and that's finally come to an end. But otherwise, you know, she's still doing her television show for PBS.
And when a cooking club becomes an eating club, the fun begins. It's all coming up today on Sarah's Weeknight Meals.
And she does a weekly radio show with Chris Kimball for NPR.
Sarah, how are you?
I'm great, Chris, and I think it's time to get to the phones.
Open up the lines. Let's go.
All right. The mix this year, as always, is wonderful, but it starts on this very strange note. The Paul Tripp song.
Yeah.
So he is from what I read, a children's entertainer.
Uh-huh.
But it's this very strange song called I've Got a Date with Santa.
True.
That I can only help reading as date, maybe in the romantic sense.
You're nice. I'd like to see you more, I told the jolly sir. Let's make a date, said he. Can hardly wait, said I. I've got a date with Santa at half past Christmas time. I've got a date with Santa.
In other words, it's gay as hell, seemingly. You know, it's you know, I've got a date with Santa, and it's sung by a guy to a guy, and it's unusual. You know, I bought a 45, and I didn't know what the heck it was, except that, you know, Santa Claus was in it, and I took it home and I listened to it. And then I did some research on Paul Tripp, and it turns out, yes, he was kind of an earlier version of Mr. Rogers. You know, going back to the 40s, he was the host of a children's radio show, and then he did it on television. He continued to do it into the 60s. And then also, it turns out, he was a composer of music, And he is the co-composer of this kind of children's piece of classical music called Tubby the Tuba.
All but Tubby the Tuba. A fat little tuba puffing away, but oh, so slow.
Which a lot of folks might know about. And so he's that guy. Now, in this record was released as a single, as I said, in 1965. A year later, in 66, he put out a whole album of Christmas songs, including this song. But in 66, you know, he's not singing. It's his composition, but it's sung by, you know, a room full of children. And so it's you know, it's innocent.
How does that read?
It's innocent. Right. It's very innocent. You know, it's a six-year-old boy or six-year-old girl talking about, you know, having a date with Santa Claus. But a grown man, you know, seemingly assuming the persona of a young child, but, you know, professing his steadfast love for Santa. I'll tell you what, it was... a little bit surprising. I hope it's amusing. I mean, there's a reason that I started this year with it. You know, Paul Tripp, as far as I can tell, I mean, you know, it's a matter of fact that he was married, you know, for decades and he had two children. And with all that, so I don't know anything actually about his private life, but I will say that I bounced this song off of a number of my gay friends and all of them, there was a kind of consensus. And one of them said, it is the single gayest song he's ever heard.
Amazing. I want to talk about the Aretha song on here.
Sure.
For a moment, which is from her Columbia period,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
pre
yeah.
Her sort of finding her R&B voice on
right.
Atlantic and becoming a star.
Right.
You know, she was doing a lot of jazz. This is with, you know, upright bass and guy playing brushes and all this kind of stuff.
It's been... holiday.
What do you like about the Columbia era of Aretha?
Well, I love it because she can always sing her ass off, and I agree with the consensus, which is that she didn't really find her voice until she went to Atlantic Records and started making records with Jerry Wexler. But that said, I mean, I think she was always a prodigy. She was always destined for stardom. She was signed to Columbia by John Hammond, I'm pretty
sure.
Who
produced this record, I think.
He might have.
I've looked around all over town.
Hammond did indeed produce the entirety of Aretha's 1962 album, The Electrifying Aretha Franklin, on which Blue Holiday appears.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, for folks who don't know it, at this late date, I mean, John Hammond was the guy who discovered and recorded Billie Holiday in the 30s. And in the 60s, right around the same time that he signs Aretha, he signs this guy from Minnesota who was born Robert Zimmerman and you know, went on to become Bob Dylan. And so that's John Hammond. And I think his idea for Aretha was we're going to take Dinah Washington as the model for her career here. And that's a magnificent model to the extent that you need a model. You know, Dinah Washington's fantastic, but there already was a Dinah Washington.
Hammond, for his part, said in a 1972 interview that, quote, I wanted Aretha to be R&B, but such that she wouldn't be sneered at by the jazz audience. I never wanted her to fall into the trap that Dinah Washington did. Dinah was a hell of a singer, but she finally got so commercial that her records no longer had much substance.
So, you know, Aretha recorded for Columbia for 4 years or 5 years or something, and then she ended up at Atlantic. But, you know, this record ruined me. You know, I mean, so it's recorded in 1962. Aretha would have been, you know, 20 or 21 years old. And, you know, I've been familiar with it for years, but... I gave it a fresh listen this year because Aretha died this year, and I wanted to have a track on as a tribute to her. And, the thing sounded so good. It sounded so fresh to me. And it's one of the great things about, you know, doing this kind of work now, that is, you know, paying attention to older recordings now here in the 21st century, because, you know, the digital remakes, the digital updates and remasterings, et cetera, of these records cut, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, can be, not always, but it can be absolutely astonishing. So what I'm guessing is, vis-a-vis this record by Aretha, you know, it's recorded for a major label in 1962. If you put a needle down on the record, I'm sure it sounded very good. It sounds very good. Does it sound as good as this digital version right now? I'd be very surprised.
Did you get to see the movie Amazing Grace when it was running this
week? I'm so glad you brought that up, because if you hadn't, I was going to.
Sean spoke on December 13th, which was the final day of a week-long run at New York City's Film Forum for the Aretha Franklin concert film Amazing Grace.
Yeah, I did see it. And yeah, your listeners definitely want to know about it. The movie is called Amazing Grace, and it's a concert film. She recorded for two nights at a church in Los Angeles, and it was all spiritual stuff. The year was 1972. Sidney Pollack was the director, for what it's worth. And it's absolutely astonishing. The album has been out probably since 72 or 73, but this film never saw the light of day until now. And it's transfixing, you know, and I think it's not just that she sings her, you know, she sings like an angel, as she always did. But what struck me about it is really how kind of self-composed she was, and how modest she was, and how little she had to say other than what she sang. And there are some bigger personalities, you know, in the movie, including her father, you know, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, he shows up.
But I say with pride that Aretha is not only my daughter, Aretha is just a stone singer.
And there are some star fans in the audience. Mick Jagger is in the audience. But obviously Aretha is the star of the show. And you tell me what you remember. I mean, does she have anything to say other than what she sings? Almost nothing.
Yeah, almost nothing, which is funny, because I talked the other day to a guy who wrote a book about those series of concerts. And he said that the way Bernard Purdy remembers it is during the rehearsals, she was preaching, you know, going back and forth between preaching and singing. He swears the rehearsals were better than the concert.
Now I'm mad. But, you know, I mean, it's almost inconceivable, because, you know, the concerts themselves were just so great.
Yeah, really just, yeah, unbelievable.
So we recommend.
Yes.
Super Sean and I recommend Amazing Grace, listeners to thecipher.com.
Yes, coming to theaters, I believe, nationwide in 2019, last I heard.
Great.
Yeah. Merry Christmas, Baby.
Right.
Is on there. Charles Brown is, I believe, on the recording, but not singing, maybe. It's a little dicey, I think, the personnel of the group at the time.
Here's what it is. First of all, understand, Merry Christmas, Baby was written by Charles Brown when he was a member of Johnny Moore's Three Blazers, and it first comes out in 1947.
Merry Christmas, baby. You should treat me nice. Give me a diamond ring for Christmas. Now I'm living in paradise.
It was a hit in the black community immediately. And it's since become, so now it's more than 70 years later, and it's been re-recorded dozens and dozens of times. And you know, I tend to think of it as kind of like the African-American version of White Christmas by Bing Crosby. It's that iconic. And having said that, you know, I don't know that there started to be cover versions by other artists really until maybe 1958. Chuck Berry did a cover of it in 1958. And as a matter of fact, it happened to be on last year's Christmas Jollies.
Merry Christmas, baby. Really did treat me nice.
Right?
Yeah.
But this woman, Marie Jones, I don't think she had a very big career, but she cut this version in 1952, just 5 years after the original, and she did it in the company of Johnny Moore's Three Blazers, minus Charles Brown.
Okay, yeah.
Merry Christmas, baby. You sure did treat me nice. Baby.
But, you know, this song, just for fun, I want to give you something. I did my homework, Sean, a little bit of homework here. It was so amazing to me. So I'm thinking about, you know, who all has covered this record or this composition over the years. It includes the jazz guitarist Kenny Burrell. Mae West did a version. Otis Redding did a version. Elvis Presley recorded it. Bruce Springsteen recorded it. CeeLo Green and Rod Stewart with Trombone Shorty. John Legend. And by the way, Pepe the King Prawn was one of the Muppets. He did a version.
Christmas, pretty baby, you sure did treat me nice.
Merry Christmas, baby, sure did treat me nice. Merry, Merry Christmas, baby, sure did treat me nice. I said, Merry Christmas, baby. You sure did treat me nice. Merry Christmas, baby. Sure did treat me nice. Yeah.
Merry Christmas, baby. You sure did treat me nice. Oh, yes, you did.
What do you think it is about the song?
It's just magnificent. You know, I mean, as I think about it, it's you know, it expresses a positive, even a jolly kind of sentiment. You know, what's wrong with, you know, Merry Christmas, baby? But the guy singing it basically has a hole in his heart. He's very, very blue for some damn reason. Mm-hmm. And he's almost pathetically grateful that his loved one has shown him some love and given him some nice presents and whatnot on Christmas Day. And, you know, it's not a secret that, you know, Christmas is an emotional time, and all of us, everybody wants it to be a Merry Christmas, and perhaps that makes it more difficult to achieve for some folks, and or those folks who can't get with the Christmas spirit, you know, feel it. Maybe they might feel their blues more intensely at Christmas time than any other time, and so this song speaks to that feeling.
Yeah. In fact, you have one of the easily, I think, the most heartbreaking song on here next. Maybe. There's some other real heartbreakers on here. But the Wait Till After Christmas, where the singer's begging, I know you don't want me anymore, but please wait until after the holidays. Just, you know, come cut me some slack.
You know how much I love you. You know I need you so. Wait till after Christmas before you go.
Let me wake you. Right. And, you know, I'm trying to think, you know, I may have heard this song in years past. But again, you know, I heard a new version this year. This thing was cut in 1954, and it sounds just magnificent. You know, and I'm talking about, you know, the sound quality. He had a career, Big John Greer. He was a not just a singer, but he was a saxophonist. And, you know, I just discovered that this song was the A-side of a song called of a single called We Want to See Santa Claus Do the Mambo. And that's a better known song.
We want to see Santa do the mambo. The mambo, see Santa do the mambo. The mambo, see Santa do the mambo. The mambo, mambo.
You know, I don't know how many of our folks listening will know that song, but I promise you, that's a song that's ended up on more, you know, Christmas compilations than this one. But when I heard this song, this way, wait until after Christmas, I couldn't leave it alone this year.
Yeah. Rick Arena is just, their song is just very, very fun. How did you stumble across them?
Well, it's not quite stumbling. I mean, you know, having done this long enough, you know, I mean, I'm going to be looking for Spanish language, you know, Christmas music. I'm going to be looking for Christmas music from the Caribbean. And there are plenty of Dominican Christmas compilations that come out. And this was on one of them. It was cut in the year 2000. These guys have been around since the mid-90s. And, actually, it wasn't cut in 2000. It was actually cut in 1998. But, I just snatched it off of a various artist compilation because,
they say their own group name a lot, which is always a positive, I think.
Oh, sure. But I'm just saying they've got that maniacal, Dominican energy, which is always pretty seductive to me. But, also, I think the song is very shapely. You know, I like there's a part towards the end of it where, you know, the lead singer leads a kind of a cheer. And he shouts out to the mujeres and they go, yeah. And he shouts out to the hombres, y los hombres, right? And they go, oh, you know. That kind of stuff, and gee, I liked all of that. And I will tell you this also: every year, I don't have to have a Dominican record on it, but you know they're dependably high energy and merry to a fault almost. And whenever I play this CD during the course of a day at any time of the year, and let's say I'm doing dishes after dinner and I'm in the living room or the dining room off the living room, and that song comes on, if my wife is in the house, if my wife and daughter are in the house, each of them will come from their respective room. They will dance into the living room. They cannot leave it alone. It's, you know, so it's that kind of energy.
Yeah. And, you know, I hadn't heard of the Fab Five, but apparently they've played on every reggae or pop reggae crossover song in the history of recorded music. So what can you tell me about the Fab Five?
I'm not a deep scholar. You know, they're also known as the Fabulous Five. They have been like session musicians going back to the 60s. They've recorded under their own name since the 60s. This record was made in 1990. It's on an album called Christmas in the Sun. Mm-hmm. And I used it on an edition of Christmas Jollies, you know, more than 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago. And, you know, I listened to it again, and I loved it again. And also, you know, one of the things that really sold me on it is that there's a tremendous video on YouTube right now of this song. And it's shot at one of the airports in Jamaica, basically. I mean, it kind of cuts between the lead singer in the studio and then this guy standing by the curb at an airport in Jamaica. And he's got three generations of his family there, his mom or his mother-in-law, his wife, his children. And, you know, I don't know if they're supposed to be, as I think about it, the idea is that, you know, like, either they're a welcoming committee to visiting Jamaicans at Christmas time, or they're going to get on a plane themselves. I don't know what it is, but it's jolly, jolly, jolly. It's just great, high energy. And let's say the song is 3 minutes and 30 seconds. So it's just so great to watch these folks having fun. And with 10 seconds left, okay, on the left side of the frame, you see one of the porters. This is just a guy who works in the airport. He is definitely not part of the crew, okay? And he dances into the video. He's wearing his airport uniform, and he could not leave this music alone. So
amazing. And that's, you know, there are a couple songs on here that are in this kind of genre of like essentially rubbing warm weather in people's faces, which I think is kind of a great subsection of Christmas songs.
Well, I mean, that brings us to John L's song, Green Christmas.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a song that's been, you know, I don't know that it's been covered over and over again, but I've heard more than one version of it. And the idea that I get is that this is the original. He wrote it. It was released in 1970. It's from an album called Here in the Virgin Islands. And yeah, it's he's consoling Santa Claus, basically, you know, because poor Santa, you know, he's you know, it's not very different, as a matter of fact, from Welcome Home, as you just, you know, mentioned, you know, nobody, it seems to be a fairly universal feeling, you know, in the Caribbean, in Jamaica, in the Virgin Islands, you know, White Christmas.
Yeah, forget all that stuff.
We're not seduced.
Yeah.
Good for you, but guess what? Better for you if you get on a plane and come and visit us at Christmas time, you're going to have a green Christmas.
Right, even if you have to ride a donkey cart instead of reindeer.
The lowest we get is 70 degrees. You yourself don't bring your sleigh, Santa, when you're coming down this way. I know that it breaks your heart to swap Rudolph and the gang for a donkey cart. I don't want a white Christmas with plenty of snow.
Right, we'll make it work.
That's right.
Yeah. One of the great themes in Christmas music is family. Either you are away from your family or you are with them, and sometimes that's complicated. But the Jimmy Donnelly song is about being away from your family and kind of talking about Santa sort of as a proxy for that, right? I can only get, I think the idea is like, I can only get home if Santa happens to pass by my house.
I'm gonna hitch a ride with old Saint Nick, won't you hear, pass your way. Yes, I'll be home for Christmas if there's room on Santa's sleigh.
Which essentially, you know, saying like, oh, I'm not going to make it home for Christmas. What is it about Christmas and being home that plays throughout all these Christmas songs?
Well, gee, I don't know. I mean, it's a national holiday of family feeling. And, you know, even if, well, let's just say this, if you've been separated from your family and you don't have some kind of a murderous feeling about your family, you know, you want to get back home and you want to, you know, share that time. And I believe, you know, it's going to start in childhood. You know, you're going to be, I'm tempted to say indoctrinated, but, you know, habituated, you know, it's going to be, you know, if your family isn't batshit crazy, then, you know, Christmas is going to be fun. It's going to be everything that's cracked up to be. And so, you know, when you get older and you go away to school or you go away, you know, and just move to another city and you begin to live an adult life, you want to get back home for the holidays and recapture that family feeling. But that's not, I don't think that's Jimmy Donnelly's story. Jimmy Donnelly's a very, very interesting guy. You know, so get this. So he's from Gulfport, Mississippi, which is kind of spitting distance to Louisiana. He's really kind of a swamp pop guy or a swamp rock guy. He was troubled. He was married 6 times and then committed suicide at the age of 33 in 1963. But so happened, and, you know, say he had a terrible drinking problem, and God knows what his, you know, his life, you know, his actual life was like, but he was agitated, not happy, but he could write and he could sing. And so, you know, he wrote songs that were recorded by people like Fats Domino and Jerry Lee Lewis. So he was much, he had talent. Mm. And he wrote this song. And this song is called Santa Don't Pass Me By. But I first heard it. I didn't hear the original, but there was an album cut in 1990 by a band called Evan Johns and his H-Bombs. And they retitled the song Please Mr. Santa Claus and put that on the name of the album, and then also did a fairly faithful version of the original.
Gonna kids, they ride with no Saint Nick. I'm sure that he'll pass your way. Yes, I'll be home.
And so this year, I finally made my way back to Jimmy Donnelly's original, and I was moved by it. You know, you're right. It's a very sad song, but you know, what can I do?
Yeah. And you know, we talked about Christmas blues before. The other Christmas blues on here, Denise LaSalle's song, is sort of, you know, I think we all can see a little bit of ourselves in a Santa who's like overworked and, you know, frustrated, and everyone around him is saying, you know, is bailing on him, and he still somehow has to pull through.
Well, look, let me say one thing also that I was very happy about. You know, I'd made a selection, you know, pretty early in the process. I had an idea about which songs were going to be on it. But, I had to mess around with the sequence a bunch of times, and it really wasn't gelling. And then finally, I realized that I had a bunch of songs about Santa Claus this year, more than usual. And so I just decided to bang all of those together. And so there's a kind of a suite of at least six songs in a row about Santa Claus. And there are, you know, a variety of different takes on Santa. And this Denise LaSalle is one of them. And yeah, poor Santa Claus, you know, he doesn't have any money, and he's old, and his reindeer have, you know, abandoned him because they don't make enough money to, you know, hang out in the cold, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, still, to me, it's charming, and I'm a fan of Denise LaSalle. And one of the reasons this song is on here this year is because, like Aretha, she died this year. And so I wanted to pay some tribute to her. I don't want to say that she was, I mean, she certainly wasn't one-dimensional, you know, and this is a straight-up, you know, a fairly straight-up song. She wrote this song, but she's better known as a kind of a Millie Jackson-styled R-rated, X-rated R&B singer. Mm. And so, one of her songs, this is a song she cut in the year 2000. She was already a fairly advanced age, and she cut a little single called Lick It Before You Stick It. And it was thoughtful of her. You know, I mean, it's a word of advice to the men in her audience.
In that Santa suite, there's maybe the earliest song on here, the Shanty Where Santa Claus Lives, or Santa Claus Lives, from a 1933 cartoon.
Oh, what a stuff, what a stuff, what a stuff, what a stuff. We are the toys for little girls and boys in the shanty where Santa Claus lives. We're taking tears and turning them to joys in the shanty.
I saw the cartoon, it's available. I don't know if you've seen the thing in its entirety.
I did.
You did?
I mean, it's only 7 minutes long or whatever.
We'll have a link to the cartoon in the show notes.
It is, it's very playful. It also, for at least some reasons, would not play very well today.
Well, it seems kind of racist sometimes.
Yes, there is. There
Big
is
some surprise.
Minstrelsy involved in,
I remember.
In a cartoon from the 30s.
Yeah.
But it's a cute little song and sort of sung by a girl group of toys in the cartoon.
Right.
Where did you come across that? Not everyone's like, this is, you know, this stumbles into cartoons from the 30s.
Well, yeah, but not everyone is, you know, quite as maniacal as I am. You know, I admit it. And, you know, I'm telling you, if you've got the, again, the mania to, you know, concentrate in this fashion, the veins of interesting material are fairly endless. So, you know, for example, speaking of cartoons, I have a friend in Seattle, Dennis Flanagan, and he used to put out, I mean, he still, I guess, puts out some Christmas CDs, like mine. He might have finally tailed off. He's older than I am, and I think he finally put this thing to rest. but he likes to help me, and he makes suggestions. And he just sent me links to, I don't know, 4 hours of Christmas cartoons, 6 hours of Christmas cartoons, something like that. And so it's going to be dozens and dozens to go through. And, you know, if I find one or two songs out of it that pass muster all these years later, good. But, you know, this was, you know, even this year for the shanty where Santa Claus lives, you know, I did watch a dozen of cartoons, and I found that one thing. And, you know, it's only whatever it is, 45 seconds long, and it's flavorful. And then, you know, we hit it and quit it.
Yeah. And maybe the, you know, one of the final songs in the Santa Suite, the Mighty Terrors song.
Right.
He doesn't seem to trust Santa Claus very much.
I can't understand what is Santa Claus' mission. In my opinion, Santa is a science man. You don't see Santa Claus when he come in. He don't rap, he don't make no noise. No, no.
No, and, you know, I leave it to your listeners to make a judgment on it. You know, for some reason, well, let me say, first of all, the Mighty Terror was a Calypsonian who, you know, born in Trinidad, but spent most of his career, made his career in England, you know, he moved to England in 1953, and before the decade was out, I think he was hailed as the Calypso King of Great Britain. But anyway, so here's a song cut in 1985 called Santa Claus Don't Have No Wife. The whole thing is premised on the fact that he'd never heard of Mrs. Claus, apparently.
Santa Claus don't have no wife, living a lonely life. Santa Claus, I want you to understand, the sweetest thing in life is a nice woman, my friend.
Santa Claus don't have no wife, living a lonely life.
The sweetest thing in life
is a nice. And so this is vexing to him for reasons that are beyond me. But, you know, that he spends the record kind of wondering about it. Why doesn't Santa Claus have a wife?
Is it because he's cheap, I think, is the main hypothesis.
But I hear he never liked to give no woman money. That's the reason why women don't want Santa Claus. So he could keep his solid cash and ladies.
Sure. And but also he seems to think that perhaps Santa just doesn't know how wonderful it is to be with a woman and to spend your life with a woman. And so, boom.
Yeah. This is a great,
but, you know, having said that, I think it's very well made, and I hadn't heard it before this year, and I heard it once and I said, well, it's got to go on.
Yeah. And then another truly sad number, before we get into some of the more uplifting stuff, Robert Parker.
Right.
Yeah. Just this horrifically sad, it involved a child, which is always, you know, way to get the tear ducts flowing.
Right.
You know, young child writing a letter to Santa, begging, you know, I don't need any presents.
Right.
I just need my family back.
Well, specifically, I need my father, mom and I, you know, bring dad back home, you know, to mom and I.
Yeah. Dear Santa, please do this for me for Christmas. Bring me my daddy home. And the little boy goes on to say, dear Santa.
Yeah, it's, you know, again, that record was cut in 1966, and, you know, I've used it in years past, and I've always liked it.
You're just trying to get everyone feeling really down at holiday time.
Well, I'm not worried about it, you know. I mean, I just, you know, the funny thing about, you know, blues music is that, you know, it might be expressing this sad condition known as the blues, but the music itself is kind of a cure for the blues. Anyway, you know, Robert Parker, for you know, folks who are of a certain age like me, you know, when I was growing up, I was a big fan of a huge national hit that he had in 1965, the year before he cut this. It was called Barefootin', where you're doing a dance without any shoes. You're barefoot.
She was doing a dance without any shoes. She was barefootin'. She was barefootin'. She was barefootin'. She was barefootin'.
And he was out of New Orleans, and he had this big hit, and that was a very upbeat song, a wonderful song. And then, you know, a year later, he cut this very sad song, A Letter to Santa. And, you know, we're listening to it this year. And you know, I think I think it's very well done. And, you know, also, it's just real. The reality of it is what moves me now as I think about it, because it's, you know, he's talking to Santa, who's this, you know, mythical creature. But what he's talking about is real life. His mom and he live alone. He misses his father. Santa, can you bring daddy home? That's real to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I couldn't help but wonder if the sensational Nightingale song you have on there, Mother Mary and Joseph, about how, you know, it's a version of the old sort of there's no room at the inn.
That's right.
You know, gospel idea.
Yeah.
There was no room. No, there was no room for the Savior of man to be born.
If your choice of that was inspired maybe by the current political situation.
No, but hold that thought, because that does apply to another selection this year. I chose it. You know, sometimes these things, you know, I'm an inveterate flea marketer, and I'll buy vinyl at a flea market. And, you know, I looked at this record by the Sensational Nightingales. It was cut in 1974. The album is fairly, it's like everyday gospel, called You Know Not the Hour. But this one song, Mother Mary and Joseph, looked like it was going to be a Christmas song. And so I paid my $2 for the record, and I took it home and I played it. And geez, I just really loved it. I love what was done musically with it. It's very loose. You know, it doesn't adhere to kind of a strict, you know, 8-bar, 12-bar form. And the guy takes his time. And I mean, they certainly know what they were doing. I mean, this group, the Sensational Nightingales, they were founded in 1942, and they recorded albums. Their last album, I think, came out in the year 2008. So they're venerable. They're practiced. And, you know, I love the performance of the song. I mean, what resonates contemporarily. So again, the record was cut in 1974, but what resonates for me is what resonates, I'm sure, there's a reason why that story, I think, was particularly embraced by Black folks in America, because they were made to feel unwelcome here. There was no room for them here. And so they're going to focus on the story of Jesus, who, you know, there was no room for him at the inn. And so he's born in a manger. And this is yet another expression of it. And, you know, it's just, you know, a terrible, terrible indictment of America that, you know, Black folks are going to be making records like this in 1974, because that feeling of being shunned had not gone away by 1974. Now, ready? Almost 50 years later, whatever, 45 years since 1974, you know, is the song still relevant? The terrible news is, yes, it is.
Right, and even more so in that, you know, if you extend it to, you know, people trying to find the metaphorical room at the inn in a new country.
That's right.
Yeah. So I have to be honest.
Uh-oh.
That I had the name Tex Ritter was maybe vaguely familiar in the corner of my brain somewhere.
Yeah.
But I didn't know who he was, and I did not realize that he was John Ritter's dad. John Ritter, I remember from seeing, you know, Three's Company and syndication growing up or whatever. But I had no idea that was that his father was one of the most famous musicians of his era.
Yeah, he was. His era really was started in the mid 30s, and he was active into the 60s. He made records, but he also, you know, he was on the radio a lot, and he made a ton of movies. He was a singing cowboy, which was a type that you found in Hollywood at the time. You know, Gene Autry and Roy Rogers were singing cowboys, and Tex Ritter, who was indeed from Texas, would have predated him. So
And it's interesting because it's, you know, it's called Merry Christmas Polka, and the song definitely has polka elements, but it's also a country song, so it kind of bridges those two.
It's a Christmas time and the bells are a-ringing. Now is the time everyone is singing. Merry Christmas, sing the Merry Christmas Polka. Girls underneath mistletoe are a-waiting.
Well, you know, there's a thing, it's a thing about Texas. I don't think people have really, I mean, maybe I'm just speaking for myself. I don't think people have plumbed the depths of the complexity of Texas culturally. It's beyond rich. You know, the Lone Star State, it really is, culturally, it's a country unto itself. It's so vast, it's so rich, and there's so much cultural miscegenation. And one of the things that happened, and I think this was probably in the mid-19th century, is that there was an influx of, I don't know if it was Polish people, but it might have been, you know, from the East and from the Midwest, and they end up in Texas, and they brought polka with them, and it was embraced by the local folks. So that's, at this point, embedded in the DNA of most Texas musicians and certainly country musicians in Texas.
Check the show notes for a link to an article about the history of polka in Texas, including information about the 19th century influx of Polish immigrants to South Texas that Bill mentions here.
You know, that's a record that was cut, Merry Christmas Polka, cut in 1948.
Yeah. The thing about the version of Silent Night on here, there's two versions. I would say the Alan Toussaint one.
Okay.
That in some ways, it's a pretty straightforward solo piano reading.
Yeah.
But because it's him, it's still somehow so New Orleans.
Yeah.
As to kind of be mind-blowing, and I'm not even entirely sure how he manages to do it.
I just think it's who he was. I mean, you know, he's from New Orleans himself. He was a composer, a band leader, a producer. You know, he worked with a huge number of New Orleans-based musicians, you know, including, you know, Dr. John and Ernie Cado and Chris Kenner and Lee Dorsey and the Meters. Also, did I mention Ernie Cado? You know, there's a song that I just became familiar with recently. It was cut in 1970. It was written and produced by Toussaint. And it was called Here Come the Girls. And that kind of had a revival in recent years, I think starting in England. That's a great, great record, and I recommend it.
Here come the girls, 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 girls. Here come the girls, 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 girls. Looking so good, it's a doggone shame that they couldn't.
And then also, for what it's worth, you know, he's a guy, you know, if you're a hip-hopper, You may not know Alan Toussaint's name, but if you went to whosampled.com and typed in Toussaint's name, you will find hundreds and hundreds of hip-hop era recording artists who have sampled his records. That's who he was. But, you know, I like this. He put out an album in 1997 called A New Orleans Christmas, and it's not all solo piano. You know, the variety of different formats and whatnot. But I liked this because it was just solo piano. It was simple as hell. And he played with a lot of soul. So.
And there's a steel guitar version of Silent Night. Also short and kind of one time through the tune. Why put those two back to back?
Well, because it's the same song and it's two different treatments of the very same song. And because I like them both, you know, I've become friends in recent years. You know, I'm trying to think, it might be through the Christmas Jollies with a guy whose pen name is D.X. Ferris. And familiar Lar Lee, his name is Dave Ferris. But he's a music lover. He lives in the Midwest. I think is he in Pittsburgh now? Is he in Cleveland? No, he's in Akron. And he just this year published a book about Donnie Iris and the Cruisers. And they're a band out of Pittsburgh, I'm pretty sure. And, you know, they had a national hit or two. And you know, when we started talking a year or two ago, he wanted me to know more about Donny Iris, and so this past year he sent me, I don't know if he sent me a whole Christmas album by Donny Iris or if he just sent me this one track. And Dave, I'm sorry, Donny's vocal on this track did not kill me, but the intro by his guitarist, and I did some research. The guy's name is Marty Lee Haynes or something. And he's a beautiful player. He plays some slide guitar. And I thought that was enough. He does an instrumental version of it. And I just laid it down.
One of the final few songs is Terry Allen and Guy Clark. Quite a duo.
No, hold on one second. Oh. Before you get there, I want to say a word about Christy Johnson.
Ah, please.
Because she's
Canadian.
She's from Winnipeg, Alberta. And she died at the age of 35 in July of 2007. This was cut in the year 2000. She did not do a ton of recording in her short life. I think she put out one album, maybe two. And the whole idea of, you know, a blues singer and composer from Winnipeg, Alberta in the 21st century is, you know, it's going to seem far-fetched. But I thought, you know, this came on a various artist compilation put up by a label called Stony Plain. Stony Plain is the name of the label, and they're out of Canada. And, you know, I liked the general tenor of what all they were doing, but this one record was a standout. And, you know, she wrote the song, she sings it herself, she's playing guitar. And again, you can't say it's not a Merry Christmas song. You know, her heart is broken. But, you know, she performs powerfully, so there she is.
Well, Christmas is the time of year. Remembering what once was here.
And Terry Allen, Guy Clark, Xmas on the Isthmus. They seem like they were, I think one of them has now passed, but they were right. the best of friends. And it seems like their kind of jokey, endless rapport is reflected in this tune.
No angels, no mistletoe trucks, no reindeer, no shepherds.
Guy Clark died in May 2016. One of his final wishes was for Terry Allen to make a sculpture that would incorporate his ashes.
Well, the both of them, the last two tracks are by Texans. You know, this Terry Allen, Guy Clark thing, and then we'll talk in a moment about Kimmy Rhodes, who has the last song in the sequence. And, you know, I don't know kind of how and why that wasn't, oh, because they're from Texas, I'm going to bump them up against each other. No. The Terry Allen song was released in 1999, and you know I heard it for the first time probably around then, and I put a version of it on my Christmas jollies that year, and the funny thing is it came out on a promo CD that was serviced to radio, and because they serviced it to radio, they bleeped out the curse words on it. So there's a refrain in the song where the guys are bemoaning their fate, and they say over and over again, "We're shit out of luck." And in the first version, it's "We're bleep out of fuck, out of luck, not out of fuck." And so anyway, I was happy to be able to find a version that wasn't bleeped and to play it. And, you know, again, there's something about Texas, you know, I suppose, you know, these guys fall under the rubric of outlaw country, which is something that began to, you know, be a thing in the mid-70s. But it's just, you know, really what it is, as I think about it, is it's not Nashville. That's the important thing. And, you know, good for them because, you know, Nashville is a relatively uptight place. It's hard to do something, you know, free and easy, wild, et cetera, et cetera.
And right, guys, and this is obviously an irreverent song, you know.
It's quite irreverent. Yeah. So there's that, and I've always liked it.
Yeah. And so, you know, every year on the Christmas Jollies, you end with a bonus cut that, at least in the years I've been listening, has always been a love song and dedication to your lovely wife, Sarah.
That's right.
This year, it's a little different.
Yeah, and I can't say that Sarah's happy to have been replaced, you know, and bumped out of the sequence in that way. But I couldn't leave it alone. This is a funny thing. So in, you know, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I went with Sarah Moulton to the Lake Austin Spa in Austin, Texas. And Sarah was engaged to go there and do some cooking demos. And they were kind enough to extend a ticket to me as well. And it was the first time I'd been to Austin. And I was really happy to visit the city. And I was happy as well to take advantage of the amenities offered by the spa, one of which was a massage called Texas Starry Night. And, you know, I don't really know what all was different about the massage. I mean, it was a wonderful massage. It just happened to be that, you know, you got the massage at night. But the telling detail for me was, you know, when you went in, they'd ask you, what kind of music do you want? They had some categories. And one of the categories was local artists. And so that's what I chose, because let me learn something I don't know. And one of the artists who came up was this woman named Kimmy Rhodes. And she's based, you know, she's a Texan. I don't know how close it, how close she, you know, she lives to Austin per se, but, you know, she's from rural Texas. And she herself has had, you know, she's had a fairly prolific career. She hasn't earned much national attention, but her songs have been cut. Songs she's written, she's a wonderful songwriter. And, you know, her songs have been cut by Willie Nelson and Trisha Yearwood and Waylon Jennings and Peter Frampton and Emmy Lou Harris and a bunch of other people. So woman can write. And this song, you know, I've loved it, you know, since I bought it. You know, I probably bought, you know, copies of two of her CDs before I left the spa a dozen years ago. And I've listened to them and I've enjoyed them. And this one song always stuck in my head. It's called Big Old Train. And I've loved it right along. And I listened to it again this year, somewhere in the middle of the year, and it struck me that something about the mood of it and the lyrics really spoke to the president. That's interesting. The present moment. let me just read a little bit of the lyrics real quick. She says, I wish I was on a train taking me somewhere far away. Where it's headed, I don't care. I could be happy anywhere on a big old train flying down the track, rocking to the rhythm of the clickety-clack. Hey, engineer, make the whistle blow. Holler all aboard and away we go.
I wish I was on a train taking me somewhere far away. Where it's headed, I don't care. I could be happy anywhere on a big old train flying down. Rocking to the rhythm of the clickety clack. Hey, engineer, make the whistle blow. Holler all aboard and away we go.
And she sings it with a real wistfulness and a real yearning. And, you know, it makes me think I want to get on that train with her. And again, I like her. I kind of don't give a fuck where it goes. As long as it goes away from here, you know,
please. Which is why you dedicated the song to America.
That's right. That song, instead of dedicating my bonus track to Sarah Moulton this year, I dedicated it to America. And it's my prayer to the rest of the country that we get through all this.
Wow. So what is 2019 looking like for Bill Adler?
Well, one thing I'm hopeful about is a documentary movie I've been working on about the photographer Ricky Powell. And I think that may see the light of day in the new year. And I've been having a lot of fun doing that. And I'm working with some good folks. And
is there anything you can tell us about it?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think most hip hoppers will have heard Ricky's name. He was much more
shouted out by the Beastie Boys, of course, in a very famous lyric.
Right, homeboy, throw in the towel. Your girl got dicked by Ricky Powell. I think that's what it was.
Homeboy, throw in the towel. Your girl got dicked by Ricky Powell.
They got fire soul in the belly of the beast.
It's not quite Shakespeare, but you know. Anyway, I think most photographers are, you know, happy behind the camera. They choose to be behind the camera. Ricky is somebody who's equally at ease in front of the camera. You know, he's a big personality. And, you know, he's been remarkably productive. He's created dozens and dozens of iconic photos. I promise, any of the fans of, you know, LL Cool J or Run DMC or the Beastie Boys or Eric B. and Rakim or, Dr. Octagon or Method Man, you know, for example, if you love any of those artists, you will have seen Ricky's photos, even if you don't know that he shot them. So, you know, we sort of start with his star-studded career, and then we get into his life. And he's just a very particular kind of New York, downtown New York character. And, we follow him around, we dig into his life, and I think we're going to be able to tell an interesting story.
What is it like walking around Manhattan with Ricky Powell?
It's comfortable, you know. I mean, it's fine. I mean, you know, he walks around the village. You know, Ricky is so well known in the span of, you know, a dozen blocks and the radius of a dozen blocks from where he lives on Charles Street. You know, there's a sandwich shop on East 8th Street called Eva's. And if you go there, you know, they've got a Ricky Powell specialty sandwich, you know, for sale. And, of course, it's, I don't know if it's vegan, it's vegetarian at the least. And so Ricky is a local character, you might say a local hero, but people don't know him really beyond his public persona. And we're going to get beyond that. And he's a very interesting guy.
What has it been like for you as someone who played such a big role in the early years of Def Jam Rush Management to see kind of the Beastie Boys lap of stuff, of interviews and events around their book?
In October 2018, Michael Diamond and Adam Horovitz released Beastie Boys' book, a look back at their lives and careers that features contributions from the two of them, along with former Cypher guest Blake Keel Leatham, Spike Jones, Wes Anderson, founding member Kate Schellenbach, and more.
Good for them. You know, I mean, in a lot of ways, they seem kind of reclusive to me. I mean, this is really the first time since Adam Yauch's death that they've poked their head up above ground. And so clearly they're over their immediate grief. And I think they conceived of the book as a tribute to Yauch. I think they miss Yauch. They've said as much. You know, they missed him in the making of this book. You know, I think they feel that they would have had a better book if MCA was still alive. But, you know, so they've gone ahead and they've done this thing, and they put a lot of time into it, and good for them.
Mm-hmm. Have you had a chance to look at it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts you're willing to share on a microphone?
They put a lot of work into it.
Okay. That sounds good. And whatever happened, you had a video series for a while, Too Old to Die Young, where you were profiling wonderful folks.
I just let it slide. Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't build any momentum with it. I don't know. You know, I imagine I'd like to do more of that stuff, but it's not like, you know, this is something I have to do. Mm-hmm. So I'm not doing it.
All right.
You know, if a producer, a network, you know, came along and said, Bill, we want to give you a show and we'll pay you to do it and we'll pay the production costs and it'll be professional. Well, gee, you know, I'd consider that. You know, I told here, LL Cool J's got a Sirius XM channel right now. And I heard about it, you know, when it was announced mid-year this year, I guess. And I wrote him. I said, Todd, you might want to consider giving me a show. I'll do a show devoted to not rap era stuff, but the immediate era preceding rap, precursors, and it'll be fantastic. And for what it's worth, and I hate to say this word, it'll be educational as well. And my old friend LL Cool J, whom I've known since he was 16 years old, has yet to reply to my offer.
Well, Todd, if you're listening, you know, hit him back, please. And most importantly, have you already started making notes for next year's?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've got several pages of notes already. And you know, it might seem maniacal, but you know, it's got to make at least a little bit of sense as well, because you know, this time of year, you know, there's an awful lot of talk about new Christmas records just being released, and you know, everybody is swamped by, you know, the river of Christmas recordings that have been recorded since there were recordings. And so it's an easy time to learn new stuff.
What are Bill Adler of Xmas Jolly's fame's own Christmas plans?
Well, I'm a Jew at Christmas, as we've discussed, I think, before. And so it's not like there's anything competing for my time. You know, my family, nobody in my family celebrates Christmas, but I married a Gentile woman and her family celebrates. And I will do what I always do, which is spend my time with my wife and my children and my wife's father, my father-in-law, Henry H. Moulton, who is now 94 years old, and will be in the country in Massachusetts, and it'll be fine. And I will have my Christmas jollies with me, and it'll be the soundtrack for our Christmas.
That sounds like a great place to end. Bill, thank you, as always, for talking about this year's mix.
Fun for me. Thank you for having me.
Christmas is my favorite time of the year for many reasons, but not least of them is the chance to talk to Bill about his mix. I've been Christmas record shopping with Bill and can attest firsthand to his devotion. I'm blown away every year by the quality and variety of the songs on the Christmas Jollies, and even more by the stories behind them. I hope you've enjoyed them too. Have a happy holiday and join us in 2 weeks for a very special episode of The Cypher. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Cypher Show. And don't forget, more information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
He had a terrible drinking problem, and God knows what his actual life was like.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
That's it. You're fired.
Audio engineering by Rob Van Vranken.
This guy from Minnesota.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
He was a composer of music.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
And the guy takes his time.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Nico Baria.
They will dance into the living room.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
So listen, you see, I've taken notes here.
Yes.
And I will be referring to them.